I want to welcome you to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. This podcast is coming out of the Trauma Informed Educators Network Facebook group. I am so looking forward to talking to people globally about their trauma informed journey. As the principal of Fall Hamilton Elementary School, a trauma informed school in Nashville, Tennessee, I have learned that this is not a destination and it truly is a process of learning and adjusting. So, this podcast will be speaking to guests all over the world about people who are just starting their journeys and people have been on this journey for many, many years. So I hope you enjoy our guests. I hope you learned something just as I am. And welcome to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. This is episode number 52 of the podcast, and today's guest is Dr. Michael Gaskell. He is the principal at Hammersgold Middle School in East Brunswick, New Jersey. Following experience as a special educator and assistant principal in Paramus, New Jersey, he continues to model the pursuit of lifelong learning as he serves as a mentor to new principals throughout the New Jersey Leaders to Leaders program. He is a STAR and NJPSA STARS recipient. He has published in over 24 articles in educational journals and blogs, including School News, NASSP, EdTech Smart Brief, and ASCD Smart Brief. He has made the most read sections of ASD Smart Brief numerous times. Mike had a book published in October of 2020 and a second book publishing in September of this year, Leading Schools Through Trauma. Dr. Gaskell works tirelessly to support instructional excellence and student success for his school community, and most importantly, for the wellness and equity of all children. Here's what Dr. Gaskell had to say. All right, here we are live on the 52nd episode of the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. And I have to admit, it's been a few weeks. I just kind of got into a lull of trying to manage life in school and had to kind of take a couple weeks off. But here we are, and I am so excited about today's guest, which is Dr. Mike Gaskell. Dr. Gaskell, how are you? Welcome to the podcast, and just let us know your story.
Yeah, it's great to be here with you, Matt. Thanks so much. And first of all, I hope you're feeling better. And that's tough to come out of a spat like that. So take your time with it and take care of yourself, which is one of the messages I have. And just a quick story about me, what drove me to write a book about trauma and how to help educational leaders and educators deal with it is very both personal to me and part of my professional career. So I'll start with the personal side. A few years back, my daughter was snooping around my parents' house. And as kids will do, she discovered something, and it was just a folder labeled Mike. That's all it had on it. And she opened up the folder, and in it was a plethora of detailed information about what kinds of struggles I went through in school. And it all sort of rooted back to third grade when I had a child study psychological done on me that really gave some very potentially discouraging news about my future. It talked about me being anxious, impulsive, delayed, socially struggling, all kinds of things. And, you know, I didn't really know it was that bad. I knew that I had some challenges when I was in school, but I never knew at that point. And then coming full circle as an educator and looking at that from a clinical perspective, it really made me realize, wow, so how did I get out of that? You know, how did I get past that and through that? And secondly, more importantly, how can I give some of that back to kids? So that's what got me to the professional side of this, because I was a special educator before I was a principal. And that really inspired me. I've had kids who didn't know how to read and write in sixth grade that I helped learn to read and write. One case, a kid graduated West Point. So when I see stories from end to end like that, it inspires me and inspired me to write this book. So that's a little bit about me and what got me driven to do this.
So tell them the title of your book, because I know we're going to dig into it and we're going to dig into some pieces. Of course, we're not going to read the book to them because they'll have to get it and read themselves. But tell them the title of the book. And I think the premise of why you wrote it is intriguing. I mean, to hear that is powerful.
Yeah, it's called Leading Schools Through Trauma, a Data-Driven Approach. That's it.
Awesome.
To helping children heal. And That's the name of it. Yep.
And in that book, you come up with processes. And I think when you're talking trauma-informed education, I think that building systematic approaches is imperative, right? Not just trying little things and calling it trauma-informed. We have to build systems and we have to build structures. So tell the listeners about that structure, that three-step process that you have developed.
Sure. Again, everything has to be something that's hands-on that that both teachers and leaders in education can walk away with and use right away. So that was my objective. And there's a three-step process, as you said, Matt, and the first one starts with fun, relationship-building activities, and that's all rooted around the idea that we need to consider the child's wellness. The second step in that process, and this is going to almost sound like the converse of step one, but I'll explain why, is to give a lot of small formative assessments. So, wow, we're going to assess the kid. Doesn't that traumatize kids? But I'll explain why that works in a second. And that's to gauge their current performance state and to make it manageable in small doses. So that's why, is that, in fact, there's research that came out in The Atlantic a few years ago. Jessica Leahy, well-known author, wrote this. And she talked about how their more frequent, shorter assessments are far more effective than summative long-term ones in a child's learning process. And that's simply because they're less formal, and they're also going to get more authentic and targeted data from kids and help them move along a trajectory in a smoother pattern. So I get a lot more clinically into that in the book. And then the third step is to challenge students to set goals just above their current ability or comfort zone. You don't want to make it so unrealistic that they just give up. You also don't want to keep them in like a stasis where they're like succeeding, but it's easy. You know, we just want to pull them just outside of that. And that's a concept I call small wins, which comes from the business side of research. And what's interesting is there's very little research on this about children. So I was really compelled to make sure I wrapped this into the book and referred to this research from outside of education and said, hey, bring this in, build on kids' small wins and develop their confidence and their learning and their trajectory overall. So that's basically, in a nutshell, that three-step process.
And I couldn't agree with you more with the small wins. And I've noticed as an active principal, just like you, that confidence is a really big thing, not just academically, but the social emotional health of our kids, right? That when things get hard, that ability to say I can do hard things is challenging. And that self-confidence sometimes comes in a way that is very low. And building that capacity inside of that circle of their capacity is so important. And I love that you mentioned that. So what makes your book stand out? What makes you go, hey, this is what's different than what other books said? And I love the idea of small wins, because that is something that I think in academics especially we get. But when we're talking about social and emotional health, sometimes we miss it. But what makes your book stand out? What makes it different?
I think the important distinction with my book is, you know, we get a lot of workshop PD training ideas and they sound wonderful, but it's about time, and it's about how much time we're restricted to do in reality. And we are very busy. That hasn't changed. It's probably only increased even as we came out of the pandemic. And it's so important to remember that we need to arm educators with short stacked interventions. These are things that can happen quick. And they can have a quick, powerful, effective effect. The other thing to remember about educators, of course, is if they're not counselors, they're not trained to give more thorough, deeper-seated kinds of time-consuming supports. That's what counselors are for, and we need counselors in that role. So I'm not dismissing counselors at all. What I'm saying is teachers spend most of the time in the trenches with kids, and they need to be able to integrate this, not add it on, but make it, you know, included. A lot of these things teachers are already sort of informally doing anyway. So it's really important to encourage teachers to realize, oh, I kind of do things like that, and make it a little more structured of a process. And when we integrate these short interventions that I call stacked, because let's say you throw seven ideas out at a kid, or you're doing seven of these tiny ideas, right? And four of those things work. Who cares if three of the things don't work? You throw them out and you focus on the four, and you're still getting four successful things to help build a child success and get them away from or through their, as I like to say, through their trauma.
And what are some of those short stacked interventions that, that you've, I don't want to give your whole book away because I think people, but if you could give a little bit of a nugget to say, hey, these are things that I'm talking about. And I agree, right? What works with one kid will not necessarily work with another kid. And I think there are processes in which we understand self-regulation, dysregulation, and co-regulation. We understand the neuro responses to that and even the physiological. But when it comes to those connections, some things work with kids and some things don't. So what are some examples of those short stacked interventions that you have in your book?
Be happy to throw a few at the audience. First of all, there's a few, a handful I'm going to throw out there so you can look at those, but you can also look further, as you, like you said, in your own research or check out the book. The first one I like to call coffee talk, and it sounds kind of funny, but I'll explain what that means. And that's the idea that researchers wanted to find out what's the most ideal background noise, because we already know that ambient noise tends to work with most individuals and especially has a larger impact on the range of bringing kids out of distressed circumstances into a more calm and focused, more deep work kind of a state. So this deep work has this high satisfaction level because we're feeling like we're actually completing fulfilling tasks that are rewarding to us. And so coffee talk is this cool thing. It's this literally idea that researchers discovered that when you're in a coffee shop, the background noise is such an ideal sweet spot that it sort of hits this perfect decibel level. You don't have noticeable noise. It's actually inaudible generally. You can't really distinguish what people are saying, which is good because you're not distracted away from that. And at the same time, it's sort of this buzzing kind of a soothing sound that keeps you in this, what I like to call distracted focus. And this distracted focus distracts you away from the things that are most unfocusing and keeps you focused on the task that you want to fulfill. That's why a lot of people tend to go to a coffee shop, or at least they did before pandemic, and could just sit there for hours on a computer or have a great conversation with somebody for hours that they hadn't seen for a long time. And so this is coffee house chatter, and there's this excellent option. So it's really easy to hop on the YouTube and just type in coffee house sounds or background coffee noises or just about anywhere online. And you can find these. I picked one up the other day. It was like 10 hours. So I don't think too many people are going to work 10 hours straight, but if they do, good for them, good on them. But on the other hand, it's really important to know that. So you might say, well, okay, that sounds great, Mike, but how can I use that in the classroom? Well, it's very easy. Most kids nowadays either have a device that's issued to them by their school and or a cell phone. And armed with one of these two things, they're going to be able to plug some headphones, cheap headphones in, go to this website and listen to the coffee house sounds while they're doing their independent work. And it does really create this ambiance that gives them this really settled focus. It takes about 5 minutes, according to the research. So you're not right away focused. It doesn't like you jump right in. But once you get settled into this, you can really get grooving. And most people respond very effectively to this. So that's one example I wanted to share, the coffee talk concept. The other one I want to mention, we hear about this, but I wanted to give a simple, quick technique, and that's breathing exercises. There's something called the 4-7-8 method, and the 4-7-8 method, what a method like this does, it's not the only one, it's just a quick and easy one to remember because it's easy to remember 4-7-8, things in blocks of three, is that you're actually moving the diaphragm in different ways that you're almost like literally massaging it. This has a very soothing effect physiologically in your body that then translates to circulation in your brain, and all the things that we do to soothe ourselves. It's almost like you're giving yourself a self-massage. And it's a very soothing way to do that. This is a really good technique for those kids who get really hot, who you just seem to think, oh my gosh, how many are going to get them? If we can teach them to self-regulate with a skill like this, what's so great about this is they can take their breath with them anywhere. They don't need anything else with them. And they're going to be able to actually access this once they learn on their own. Now, you can coach them through this, and it's a very simple technique. But really the key is you want to teach them to do this. And the other day, I was driving my daughter to a cheer competition, and I heard her breathing very systematic ways. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, I'm doing the 4-7-8 method. So I didn't want to say, see, daddy told you so, but I was pretty proud of that because it showed me that even a teenage girl is accessing this and saying, hey, this works. And I asked her about it. And she said, it works, daddy. It really works. It helps. And she's a very anxious child by nature. The other one I wanted to mention is something called gamification. And if you Google gamification, it's kind of this loose term that you see different definitions for. But the main thing about gamification is that teachers are very familiar with the idea of getting on like Kahoot or Pear Deck or Nearpod or one of these kinds of resources and having students do a review or a fun end of the week activity or before the holiday. What they don't necessarily realize is there's lots of valuable data in those responses that are accessible later on. If kids are getting on and signing in and all these types of gamification resources I mentioned, as well as many others, allow kids to log on and access this, typically through Google Chrome or Google Classroom or whatever. And it's very easy then to collect those responses. So if we can be thinking about targeting those responses, we're already doing this anyway, and then getting those responses, sharing those responses with the students and showing that in September I did this and November I'm doing this. Wow, look at the trajectory. Look, and again, showing them very visually, very concretely, this is the progress you made since September. Kids sometimes don't realize that they're moving, even at a slower pace, they're still moving in and up. It might be a remarkably imperfect, but nonetheless, it's an upward trajectory, a curve. So we need to show them that so they feel inspired and invigorated. A lot about confidence building. I was a special educator, and I found that helping kids build their confidence was all the difference. They could then compensate almost always for their disability because of that confidence building. The last one I want to mention interventions called the two-minute intervention and the one-sentence intervention. And they are as simple as they sound. A two-minute intervention can be a really quick feedback conference where you're checking in with kids, where you're giving them very critical kinds of delivery of feedback. And just a real quick thing about a study. I know we're going to talk about studies a little bit later, but a really cool study where a business tested out some of their employees by having delivery of feedback be very neutral, it was positive, but it was neutral tone. And it was, you're doing a good job and everything's fine. And then on the other hand, they had people that were very nurturing, but critical feedback. And when they were surveyed afterwards, the people that said, when I was criticized, I was given such support that I actually preferred that over the people that were getting the very neutral kind of bland feedback. So it's the same idea with 2-minute interventions. It's not always what we say, but how we say it. And there's so much impact on kids in picking up those vibes. They're very keen to that, as we know. And it's very important, especially with distressed or traumatized children, that they're even more heightened awareness about that. All their primal senses are firing and ready to go. So we just have to be very sensitive to that. And the same thing with the one-sentence intervention. One-sentence intervention is great because it has to be more continuous on a daily basis, but it's very easy to do and to track. So I get into a lot of these ways to track these in the book and more systematic ways to integrate it right into our instruction. And a one-sentence intervention can be, hey, I really like your shoes today. I like the way you came in on time today, even if the kid's has been a real challenge, because when we keep giving them this positive feedback, it's going to counterbalance or overrun the negative, which I'll talk a little bit about the positive to negative ratio later as well. So those are just a few of many ideas that I give, both easily integratable into what we're doing, and then also just easy to bring right in and continue doing to help support kids.
That's awesome. I would love to know, because you said the 4-7-8 breathing method. What does that look like? What is it? How do you engage in a 4-7-8 breathing method? And I don't know how much you know about my school, but we really deeply believe in the power of breath and even the polyvagal idea of the being able to use breath to calm our nervous system, right? And we use pulse oximeters to actually show kids their superpowers of that breath. So I'm really curious on what does 4-7-8 look like? How do you guide a student through 4-7-8 breathing?
Yeah, it's as simple as breathing in for 4 seconds, breathing out for 7, and then breathing back in for 8. And doing this for a series of at least 3 to 4 consecutive times. Once you get past the 3rd or 4th time, you can start to immediately feel this effect. So that's a quick amount of times. If you think about that numerically, it should be just about a minute or under a minute. Not saying to stop at a minute, but that will already start to have an effect at that point. And this is something a kid can be doing walking down the hall. So that's how powerful that is. And that's why that whole self-regulation of that and teaching them that, that's a lifelong skill that kids can carry with them. And so isn't that what helping kids through trauma is all about, is helping them not just heal to get through a school day, but really to appreciate and get the most out of life.
You know, and I wore my Be Well in School shirt. You might be able to see it here if you're watching.
I see.
That is exactly that. We have a Be Well partnership where every kid as a whole class goes through processes like you just said, right? These breathing processes. We do use breathing balls. We do use different techniques. But what we're teaching them to do is the power of breath. And I couldn't agree more. The research is undeniable. And it's and anecdotally, I can tell you as a previous competitive cyclist, I use the power of breath to control my heart rate in the midst of some really intense mountain bike and road races. And so,
which mirrors some of the physical reactions these kids are having.
You're exactly right. Heightened heart rate, breathing heavily. You're in that, you know, your body is struggling.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So awesome. I love that. And I think to reinforce what you said by a previous guest on here, Dr. Bruce Perry, who recently wrote the book, What Happened to You with Oprah Winfrey, you know, his current research is very clear in saying those micro interactions, those positive high doses of affirmation play a huge role to the point where they're actually saying the outcome is better than a 50-minute therapeutic session a week. And that is important.
Wow.
And to reinforce that even more, Vanderbilt University did a study at my school where they track transactional interactions, which means kids got tickets, and then they had relational interactions where kids got affirmations. And undoubtedly, the class that had the affirmation, a teacher actually wore a buzzer, and every 3 minutes it would buzz her. The kids couldn't hear it, and she would affirm the class, multiple kids. It was by far very clear that personal affirmations and what you refer to as those 1 minute or one sentence interventions had a great impact. And then one more, Dr. Karen Treisman out of the UK, she has a quote that says, every interaction is an intervention. And I think that is exactly what you're saying, that any interaction we can have has intervention. So let's talk about the research that you used to culminate all these pieces to write your book. And I will admittedly tell you, I am a research nerd, unapologetically. Love it. Like, only thing I read, I should probably read some novel or something, but all I read is research. So let's talk about it. What are some of the research that you dug into?
Yeah, so you're a research nerd and I'm a research geek. So how's that? So I'll start with, because it's a great segue right into John Gottman's research. John Gottman is this guy who studied successful long-term marriages. So these were marriages that were thriving decades in. And of course, this is a very interesting topic because we know, we all probably know very well, the divorce rate is somewhere around 50%. So this strikes a chord for many. And he wanted to just know what's working, what's making a difference in these marriages. And it was a very, very simple yet powerful thing. There was an average of about 4 positive statements that were issued by each spouse to every negative interaction. So think about that balance. And by the way, that range tends to go from 3 to 5. So that's why I stick with the number 4 if you look at the different research on this. And it's amazing. So you think about the fact that if you're issuing 4 positives to 1 negative, that's not as hard as it may sound. And they don't have to be big things. I mentioned earlier, I like the way you came in on time, even if the kid comes in and sits down and laughs or is disrupted. The fact that he heard that or she heard that is going to have ultimately over time an impact because you're simply continuing to give more positive than negative. Now, you may have to make that one negative a big one, like stop running around the room or something. But again, it's this idea that we can, and make sure they're authentic though. So we're not going to make something up that the kid knows right away. Because again, kids are very keen to this. They're going to tune out that she's just doing that to make me feel better or to get me to behave or something like that. So, but again, you know, I like this, or, you know, I appreciate you doing that. Or there's a lot of these micro interactions that happen all throughout a class or a hall or wherever the situation is. And it's very easy to track these. This comes out of research from PBIS, which is well known nationally, in PBSIS in New Jersey. It's a sister state program. And, you know, there's again, this is one of those things you go right online and see some examples of teachers doing this. And, you know, they're just literally checking off at first to get used to it without anybody knowing that she's checking off like your buzzer. or that they get so good at it that they, because after time you get used to it and you don't really realize you may be giving three or four negatives. It's very typical to a positive. And here's the problem with that. Kids that are traumatized, kids that are disadvantaged, kids that are difficult or struggling kind of all fall in the same category. They're used to adults giving up on them. Why are they used to it? Because they're difficult. And they sort of want to affirm that every adult's going to do this, whether, you know, whether they want to admit that or not. When they see that that changes with somebody, that has a powerful impact. So that's why we definitely want to do things like what John Gottman suggests and bring it right into a classroom. Move on to another study. Geek to nerd. Sounds good. So Emmy Wiener did a really cool study where she studied kids from the time they were born until they were in their midlife. And so basically, this is another longitudinal study. These were kids, they were isolated on the island of Kauai. They had grown up there, they had lived there, they had spent their whole life there. So there was this really sort of autonomous control group as a result that you could really sort of not worry about exterior factors changing the results. And they were able to identify, there was a pretty high poverty rate there on the island. So about a third of these kids were identified in early childhood as at risk. They were very clearly showing some of those signs, like I mentioned, that I had when I was evaluated in third grade. And that, you know, they were anxious, they were high risk, they were getting themselves in a lot of trouble, they were impulsive, they were delayed, they had language issues, the whole thing. And yet, of those students, there was a couple hundred of these students, about 50 some odd of these kids or so, some high number like that, actually were able to show later in life that they were highly successful, that they were living normal lives, had families, the whole thing. So Emmy Wiener and her group wanted to know what the heck happened here. Why was this working for this group of kids? So they went back and looked at some with research, very detailed, what happened with these kids, what worked, because then we could translate this right to other circumstances with challenged or traumatized or distressed kids. And what they found was that these kids were getting things like an affiliation. So that might be with a church or a team or something like that, where they were making a connection. That was one big thing. They were getting an affiliation. The second thing that they were getting was a mentor. Almost never was that mentor a parent. It might have been a distant relative, but it was not a surrogate parent, a mother or father. And so they were getting, a coach, a teacher, a pastor, somebody close to them that could help guide them through life. And then there were some other things that helped teach those kids some really strong resilience and give them those opportunities. So there was these characteristics, and I get more into detail on that in the book as well, because I definitely referenced that study as just a great example of this group of kids that started out traumatized, basically, and they became successful adults. The last study I'll mention in this group of discussion points is the Pygmalion Effect Study. Pygmalion Effect Studies is also this really cool study that was done way back in the 60s. You might say, well, why are we talking about a study from the 60s? And there's a couple of reasons. First of all, it's not very well known, but for those of us that do know this study, it was one of those studies that ethically couldn't be done today. And the reason that that's the case is they took this group of kids and they said to the teachers in this, Rosenthal and his crew, took this group of kids and said to the teachers, okay, this group of kids, they're just average or below average. And then they said, these guys over here, they're gifted. And so we just want you to be aware of that in September. And do you know that in June, and by the way, here's the catch, here's the rub, none of these kids were gifted. They were all average, somewhere around the roughly average performance level. The kids who were considered gifted ended up producing outcomes that reflected gifted students. So again, what happens, right? Expectations, support, that mentor I talked about earlier, because mentoring is a strong part of helping kids through trauma. All of those kinds of factors where they were called on more, they were pushed to go further with their answers, all of these things, whereas the other kids just either performed average or below average because that's what they were expected to be. So again, a study that ethically might not be able to be done today because obviously there's some equity issues there, but a cool study to grab onto to say this is another example of things like delivery of feedback and how we make kids feel and some of those expectations, getting them slightly out of their comfort zone and keeping to nudge them rather than just saying, oh, you did that today, you're fine. So those are just a couple of those cool, really cool studies that tie right into the work I talk about how to build strategies in the book.
And Mike, I know we couldn't do that study, but I think that Pygmalion effect is 100% enacted today in education. I mean, it is. Well, the kid is from here. They can't do this. Or
right.
They're so far
behind. It's institutionalized.
That you're exactly right. And it's the foundation of our system. And please don't think I'm educational system. I am a public school administrator. Right. As you can see underneath and behind me, I also am an unapologetic disruptor who wants to unite with other disruptors to say, when you said it's an equity issue, it's still an equity issue. We do characterize kids by all kinds of characteristics, whether it's demographic, whether it's race, whether it's socioeconomics, whether it's zip code, whether it's the house they live in. We tend to, by our own design, be biased in ways based off of our previous experiences, and that's how our brain categorizes information to rapidly pull it up in an efficient way, right? And I think that
Absolutely.
Is a fact, that impact right there has a huge difference in schools. If you told the teacher, every kid in this class has this amount of ability, push, right? Or see what potential they have. We want to do that, right? But there's so many things that say, like the tests that we have to categorize our schools by, that says these kids can't do this, right? And the state says, okay, you're in the bottom 5%. You're a low-performing school. Your kids need to do better. But what we're telling you is they can't do it, right? It's all of these layers of things that I don't think the studies are there, but because ethically we can't. But I think the systems are still in place that reinforce what you just said, which in the South here, because I do live in Tennessee, is what we refer to as bless their little hearts. Right? We don't want to bless kids' hearts in this work. We want to build capacity. We want to set environments where kids can meet their fullest potential through strong, stable, nurturing relationships. Agree?
I was just thinking of something that we do in my school that starts to help rewire the perspectives of teachers, which if you don't mind, I'll just share this real quick because it's a really cool thing. A couple years ago, my superintendent came to me and he said, we have to move 200 preschoolers to your middle school. And I thought, wow, that's going to be hard to do. Where am I going to put them and how am I going to separate them? And well, of course, like any good principal, I figured it out. And I said, I have a solution. But of course, it was a challenge and I was worried about it. I was worried about how they were going to integrate. And then one day I started talking about an idea with somebody about a kid who showed a lot of potential, but he was from the wrong side of the tracks. And you could literally say that this kid would walk too fast and talk too loud down the hall and the whole nine. And yet he had this contagious smile. And if you look beyond and he was like 6 feet tall for a middle school kid. So he had this, you know, overpowering presence and teachers just made assumptions about him. They just did. And these are great teachers, by the way, that made assumptions about him. My teachers are fantastic, but you know, they had formed an opinion. So we got him after he had a good few days of school to go read to the middle school, to the preschool kids. And here's the thing, might have had some literacy issues, but just about anybody can pick up a Dr. Seuss book or something at that reading level and feel comfortable reading that. And the best part is when 3 and 4 year olds are high-fiving that big middle school kid, he don't look so tough anymore. And when you take pictures of that and advertise it and talk about that kid, suddenly adults, he's feeling a lot better. Because that's like pet therapy, by the way, for a kid. And then it became the cool thing for some of my most challenged kids to do. And suddenly teachers are having different conversations with that kid. Not slow down in the hall, not you're talking too loud. But when he is doing that, going over and saying, hey, I heard you read the other day. I heard that was a great job. And suddenly his whole demeanor changes. And that teacher didn't even have to say a single thing about him running too fast.
You know, this idea that we have to break kids down, and I know that people don't want to talk about the reality. No, it's talked about in education, right? 2 weeks, can't smile, you got to burn around. Listen, I don't understand this. Like, and even being a father, I have a 10-year-old. He has had encounters with educators that I'm like, are you just really just trying to break spirits? Like, He yep. already is hard enough on himself. He doesn't need somebody else telling him, well, yeah. you did this wrong, blah, 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 right? And I think we have to shift the way that we see so much in education from what it used to be. Because let's be honest, kids have access. Kids see more, do more, know more than I did when I was in high school. They're learning more than I did when I was in elementary, middle, and high school. And I think sometimes we want them to respect us and we want them to do what we say, but in return we disrespect and have those negative impact. So what I heard you say was, and I agree 100%, you got to find the good and you got to empower kids and every kid. And I say that from a kid that was told he wasn't always good, right? And was suspended.
Sounds familiar.
You know, I mean, in just finding, and I tell a story all the time. I find it ironic. I was standing on a stage in England for the second time speaking to a crowd. And I remember somebody saying, you know, you really think you're going to make a difference in the world, don't you? Well, you just need to focus on your classroom. That's when I was a teacher. And I thought, I actually kind of had that Jekyll and Hyde laugh in my stuff. Because I'm like, no, look, it really is. But when teachers even do that to other teachers, imagine what happens with our kids. And I appreciate mm-hmm. your approach because it's what we all have to do. There is no broken kid. It doesn't exist. There's kids that need that connection, empowerment, and what you just said. Power of empowerment is priceless. I believe that. Giving kids jobs, letting kids do things, making them a part is it's undeniable. It makes a major impact.
Yeah, virtually every behavior is for attention. That attention can be negative. And by the way, disadvantaged children are used to finding it that way. So that's why they have a tendency to lean towards that. And when they're offered the opportunity for the reverse, you'd be surprised at how often they step up. And if we continue to insist on that, they can rise to the occasion. They absolutely can.
And coming from, I was a foster parent for almost 2 years. And I can tell you the expectation was we were going to do that with our two boys. And some days it was hard. I'm not going to lie. Like, this work is hard. And I think what people need to understand mm-hmm. is this actually increases our accountability, not the kids. It increases right. our accountability, which then ultimately increases kids' accountability because we're holding ourselves to a higher expectation of understanding the power of regulation, dysregulation, and even triggering. And I think that's conversations that have to happen. So what do you see the next steps to be in your work as you're moving forward or in the field in general of trauma-informed education? What do you see the next steps being?
I think there's a lot about, I mean, we talked about this throughout the conversation, equity and tackling some of those challenges because it's obvious. And you had mentioned, yeah, we don't have a study like the Pygmalion study that we can do today, but anecdotally, we know it's happening. And you can also look at suspension rate proportions demographically and know that we have a problem. So you have to look at alternatives. You have to insist on things like restorative justice opportunities. I have a restorative service plan, I call it, at my school. And it's also combined with a mentoring opportunity where teachers, instead of duties, sign up for this, and they sign up for it with a lot of interest. And they get to meet kids and get to know them that aren't their students, and they get to work directly with them in just a cause and effect kind of an opportunity and say, okay, so what happened and went wrong here? What can we do to avoid in the future? And remember me if you need me, and I'm here. And then if they see them down the hall and that kid's kind of goofing off, they kind of get that look like, hey, you know, remember me? And again, there's that mentor that I went back to in the study with Emmy Warner. They talked about the power of mentors, and you can look all over and find tons of research on this, by the way, about mentoring. So the other thing is it's these snapshot ideas. Teachers don't have the time to go to a full day workshop or 2 days worth of workshops, unless it's in the summer, and leave their classroom and then apply all of these longer term systematic things. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to offer a refreshing approach that says, yes, you can integrate. One really quick example of this, teacher greeting at the door. There was a study done a few years ago, behaviorally disabled children or behaviorally challenged children, as I like to say, call them. How quickly can we get them on test behavior? That sounds like a challenge. And as a basically baseline, they found that 45% of the time they would come in ready to learn. So that's not a great percentage. Simply change one thing, did nothing else to change one thing. They greeted them at the door. And they greet them at the door, by the way, with like a one sentence intervention, by the way. And when they greet them at the door, that figure jumped from 45 to 72%. Now that's a massive jump. And when you think about it in terms of, you know, teachers by nature of who they are, generally are great people who want to help kids. They didn't, as I like to say, we didn't get into this business to get rich. We did it because we care about children. And so that's a great baseline to work with because we know that they want to do that. Unfortunately, that can sometimes actually backfire because teachers want to help every kid. And what I often have to say to them is, look, get many kids working successfully most of the time. Not all kids. You need to think about this like a bell curve. Let's shift the bell curve. Let's not try to get every kid. Unfortunately, you're going to lose some, and teachers have a really hard time with this. But once they get past that and understand, oh, there's a larger vision here and cause, that 45 to 72 for some teachers might not seem like a great thing because I didn't get to 100%, but nobody can get to 100%. We're all fallible, and we need to accept the fact that kids are going to be just as much. They're going to have their good days. They're going to have their bad days. If we see growth, and growth tends to capitulate, we tend to be able to continue to support it in this perpetuating kind of a spiral. And that's an important piece too. So I think it's a lot of these ideas. I'm actually, and I know you're writing a book right now, which is fantastic. I'm writing a new book. The idea about this does address a lot of these equity issues, but in a very interesting way, because I don't tend to tackle things necessarily head on because, you know, as I like to say, there's more power in persuasion than force. And by getting people to understand and see this actually working, it's going to be a lot more persuasive. The other thing is there have been days where I say I want to march into central office and eliminate this one bureaucratic thing. And you know how successful I am at that? Almost never. So instead, what I do is I politely do my research. I come up with a great idea. Sometimes I don't mention that great idea because I know they might say no right away. And then I can ask for forgiveness, beg for forgiveness later than ask for permission. And a lot of times they say to me, hey, that was not such a bad idea. And then it gets to thrive. So it's a lot of these kinds of things that work around those institutional barriers that to no fault of educators as humans that we are, but these systems that are in place that are barricading the opportunities for those that need to be provided the same opportunities and just don't receive them because of this institutionalized inequity. We need to reverse that to institutionalizing equity. And there are practical ways to do that, but it takes time and it takes commitment.
And I think what resonated with me is Jim Sporletter, who was the principal of Walla Walla, Washington at Lincoln High School under Paper Tigers, if you've ever seen that documentary,
yes, has become
a great friend of mine. And he said, Matthew, you can't reach 100% of your kids, but you can show 100% of your kids that you love them. And right. I think that's it. When you realize you just have to hold space, what I always say is we're not fixing kids. We're just setting the platform. We're setting the environment and we're setting the relationship for them to have the potential of meeting their fullest potential. Right. And I think that's so key. And I want to say another thing. What you said is exactly why I have this hashtag right here. Disruptors Unite. I don't ask for permission either. Right. When we started this journey in 2015 and when Edutopia did the feature of our school that over 7 million views or something, that was work that we didn't anticipate that anybody would come and notice. And we didn't ask. We just knew based off of the research, the current research of the impacts of trauma on the neurological on the neurology of kids and the physiology the physiological responses of kids and the nervous system. Once we learned all that, if we didn't do something different, we were actually committing malpractice because we, in the words of Dr. Bruce Berry, we knew better. We had to do better. And I think that's what I want to encourage educators at any point. If you know better, just do better. And here's the piece. I've come up with some pretty, I thought, innovative things that failed miserably, right? And I think being okay to go, okay, that didn't work. Let's step back and say, okay, let's figure something else out. But being willing to go, what we're doing isn't working, let's try something else. So Dr. Gaskell, the last question I want to ask you is, what do you want educators to know from you right now? It is, let's not lie, it's tough. Matter of fact, you've been doing this a long time. I've been doing this 15 years. It's tough. And it's tough every year, but there's a whole different sense of toughness right now that I can't pinpoint, but it's tough. So what do you want them to know?
Oh, a great question to end things. So I think the most important thing that I'd want to share with them right now is that, and I love to say this, we need to be selfish. And by that, what I mean is we need to take care of ourselves before we can take care of a kid. So one of the things that's gotten lost in this shuffle we need to recognize is teachers need to take care of themselves. Educators, leaders, we've got to do a job for ourselves. We've got to give ourselves some credit. There's a chapter in my book, by the way, about faculty self-care, and it gets into all these ideas and talks about the importance of doing this. It's the idea of putting the oxygen mask on yourself first so that you're able to then have the strength to put the oxygen mask on a child. And that's such an important thing. That's why I say be selfish. Take care of yourself first, because it's like you're not going to be able to give back otherwise. And that's ultimately, as we said earlier, why educators went into this profession. They did it because they wanted to help children. They love working with children. And you can't do that if you're not taking care of yourself. So I get into some other strategies that are more adult-like for us as educators to help put all this in perspective and to remind ourselves that we need to take that time. And even some of the strategies that I gave you for kids obviously can be used for adults, like the breathing technique and things like that. So definitely give yourself some credit. Definitely take care of yourself. Use some of those kinds of strategies. And that way you can reward yourself, and then you can reward kids a lot more.
Awesome. And I couldn't agree more. And I think that self-care isn't selfish, right? And I'm going to be honest, the word self-care just like gives me goosebumps, because it's like we hear it so much. And people are like, really, what does that mean, right? It doesn't mean yoga, unless yoga is what does it for you. It doesn't mean just have a glass of wine and get your nails done. I don't do either of those things, right? It's finding those things that where we can balance ourselves so we can stay regulated in the moment and on a long term. I absolutely agree with you 100%. So if people want to find you on social media, where can they find you? Or if they can, if they need to find your book, where can they get that?
So the easiest way to find me is on Twitter, Gaskell M. Gaskell. You can also find me at mikesmicrominute.com. That's my website, which just basically has some information about some of my ideas, the articles that I've published, as well as the book. And the book is easily findable either at Amazon or at the publisher's website, Routledge.
Awesome. And of course, for me, if you want to follow me, I'm right here on one of these. Here we go. At Principal List on Twitter and Instagram. And on Facebook, I am Matthew Portell, Paradigm Shift Education, Trauma Informed Educators Network, and Trauma Informed Educators Network Cast. If you notice, it has not been very active lately because I'm also a, like Dr. Gaskell, a full-time principal every day of the week. So I do these things for fun. And of course, you can always hashtag Disruptors Unite. That is the way we unite as a group of educators who are willing to do something different for the sake of understanding what we've always done does not work. So as always, if you need to, please, please, please wear a mask and always wash your hands.